humans have known that horses can consume protein, different types. I mean, when the book was released, there were originally 18 different types of meat, including human, that we knew horses had eaten. And this had occurred in 30 countries over a space of 4,000 years.
Ladies and gentlemen, people of America!
This English horse got loose and then systematically went through the streets of Lucknow, killing people and tearing them apart. And if you sit down with them, you say, okay, look, I'll just put it on the table and you decide. And I think that's what I'm talking about. You know, you're such a great example of this, Tim. I mean, you look at the book, you go, well, I don't know. You know, I see a lot of kooky stuff in my life, and I don't know. And at the end of the book, you go, you know what? I think the guy's kind of right.
If I put the miles in, will you invite me into the Long Riders?
Maybe. Chicago is a long time coming, and you change getting there, I'll tell you.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Benall of BenallofAmerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 6. Big thanks to our good buddy Pete Diggins for providing the theme music to this installment of the program. Check out his website, www.aurophonic.com, and you spell that AuroPhonic.com. Check it out. As noted at the end of last week's episode, tonight's program kicks off the final four of Season 6. Truly the home stretch for the season, and I can't think of a better guest for the home stretch than equestrian researcher and accomplished long rider, Colin O'Reilly, for a discussion on his groundbreaking book, Deadly Equines, The Shocking True Story of Meat-Eating and Murderous Horses. I'll pause there and let you digest that, no pun intended, The Shocking True Story of Meat-Eating and Murderous Horses. Over the course of this two-hour adventure, we're going to discuss Cullen's powerful case for meat-eating horses, including historical accounts from ancient and contemporary times, the collective equestrian amnesia that has befallen our culture, and the reaction to his research from the equestrian community, the scientific community, and people who work with horses every day. But really, that's just the meat-eating horses part of the conversation, because we're also going to discuss murderous horses, a completely separate but equally bizarre anomaly that Cullen has uncovered. He's going to have a ton of stories about murderous horses and speculation on what makes them so savage. And as if all that is not enough, we're also going to talk about Cullen's accomplished career as a long rider and his organization, the Long Riders Guild. Chances are, if you're like me before I met Cullen, you don't have any idea what a long rider is. After you're done listening to this episode, you're going to have an extensive knowledge of the world of long riding. And trust me, my friends, it is amazing. We're going to learn all about the practice, the world of long riding. I don't even know if you'd call it a sport. I'm not quite sure what you'd call it. It's almost like a vision quest. And Colin O'Reilly really is a major player in the world of long riding. So you're going to learn all about that stuff. Really a surprising sort of twist for me as I got into the conversation with Cullen, because I found the long riding stuff equally interesting to the meat-eating and murderous horses. So it's almost like a threefer episode here. Lots of stuff going on, lots of discussion on a whole bunch of different equestrian-related stuff. It is, pun intended, a barn burner of a program. This one is definitely going to end up in the rotation for BOA Audio Classic episodes. You are about to enjoy a true gem. Fascinating, enlightening, and awe-inspiring, this conversation is a proverbial long ride of esoteric insights on not only equines but also humans with the truly remarkable Colin O'Reilly. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Colin O'Reilly, allow me to provide you with a little background on him. Colin O'Reilly has spent more than 30 years studying equestrian travel techniques on every continent. After having made lengthy trips by horseback across Pakistan, he was made a Fellow of the Royal Geographical Society and the Explorers Club. Upon completing his book, Khyber Nights, he founded the Long Riders Guild, the world's first international association of equestrian explorers. The organization has members in 40 countries, all of whom have made a qualifying equestrian journey of at least 1,000 miles. The Guild has supported more than 100 equestrian expeditions on every continent except Antarctica. Cacolin is married to the Swiss long rider Basha Cornwall-Ley, who rode her Cossack stallion Count Pompey from Volgograd to London, becoming the only person in the 20th century to ride out of Russia. The O'Reillys are the webmasters of the Long Riders Guild website. At 2,000-plus pages and still growing, and having now been visited by more than 1 million people worldwide, this website is the repository of the largest collection of equestrian travel information in human history. Additional material from the O'Reillys can be found at the Long Riders Guild Academic Foundation. And let me give you the URLs for both those websites. The Long Riders Guild can be found at thelongridersguild.com. Pretty simple, all one word, the Long Riders Guild. The Long Riders Guild Academic Foundation, this one's a little easier. It's just lrgaf.org. lrgaf.org. Long Riders Guild Academic Foundation. Check it out. And with all that said, let's get down to business and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on October 12th, 2011. Colin O'Reilly talking about deadly equines, the shocking true story of meat-eating and murderous horses on BOA Audio Season 6. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 6, and I am just super excited about this edition of the program. I had the fantastic opportunity to read this man's book yesterday and was completely blown away. If I wasn't reading it on the computer, I'd say that I couldn't put it down, but I couldn't pull myself away from the computer while I was reading this book. It was just that mind-blowing and amazing and fantastically put together, too. So just a complete all-around home run effort by this guy, and I'm dying to get him on the program here to talk about his fantastic research. The book I'm talking about is Deadly Equines, The Shocking True Story of Meat-Eating and Murderous Horses. And with a title like that, I'm sure people are like, whoa, this is going to be crazy. But like I said, when I went into the book, you know, he makes the case so well for meat-eating and murderous horses that by the end of the book, you're like, you know, your worldview has changed, at least as far as equines go. So just a fantastic piece of work. And I'm just dying to dig into his brain here and find out more about this bizarre, as he calls it, O'Reilly anomaly. And kudos to him. He tagged his name there on the anomaly. I'm talking about Colin O'Reilly, coming to us actually direct from France, which is very exciting to have an international guest on the program once again. Colin, I'm thrilled to have you here on the show and can't wait to discuss deadly equines.
Thanks for talking to me about it, Tim.
I should also mention you're part of I think you're the founder of the Long Riders Guild, and let's give the website for that is thelongridersguild.com, pretty easy. And I have no real prior knowledge of horses, but and this is actually a cool part about the book, too. I learned so much beyond just the deadly equines part. I just learned a tremendous amount about horses. And I'm going to assume or presume that a long rider is someone who actually, you know, and I'm going to sound like a fool here, but someone who takes a long ride on a horse, like we're talking thousands of miles, right? Is that what a long rider is?
Yeah, the Long Riders Guild is the world's first international association of equestrian explorers. And we have members in 44 countries. Every member has to have ridden a minimum of 1,000 miles to be invited.
Wow.
It's a non-competitive, academic, international association. We have members and, like I said, around the world, and they have done some really remarkable equestrian journeys. The Russian long rider Vladimir Fasenko rode 19,000 miles from Patagonia to the top of Alaska.
Holy shit.
Gordon Naismith, the Scottish long rider, rode from the tip of South Africa to the Olympics in Munich, and it just goes on and on.
Wow. That's, see, I...
you know, I'm sure there's places where you can hear about this stuff, but I've never really heard, I didn't know this was still going on nowadays. You know, people, you think that it was obviously going on back in the day. People didn't have planes and cars, so they traveled quite a distance by horse, but for people still doing that, that's amazing.
Well, it's interesting because the Long Riders Guild started in 2000. Equestrian travel had reached such a perilous point where it was almost about to go extinct. And I had just finished a giant book about my own travels in Afghanistan and Pakistan called Khyber Nights. And I realized that, you know, we were about to lose it. And so I called the first international meeting, and there were originally five of us from three countries. And now, 11 years later, it's spread to 44 countries. It's the only equestrian association of its kind in the world. And it's open to any human who wants to get on a horse and take a life-changing equestrian journey. And we've now mentored more than 100 equestrian expeditions on every continent except Antarctica.
Wow. I don't know if I could do long riding.
Well, the thing about this is, and I think this is important for people to understand, because long riders aren't your traditional horse people. You know, if you, and I know I'm speaking primarily to an American audience, so let me put this in American context. At the beginning of the First World War, there were approximately 22 million horses in America. And by 1930, the vast majority of those horses were all dead. The cavalry was dying, or had just about gone extinct. Mechanization had taken over agriculture. People had stopped traveling because of the cheap Ford automobiles. And by the end of the Second World War, horses were pretty much, they were just pushed right to the sideline. And in the resulting vacuum that started, say, from 1955 until the year 2000, we've had a shift in how we view horses and what horses are used for. And you have a lot of prestige transport. You have a lot of social hierarchy, and horses are a reflection of who you want to be seen as socially. And long riders and equestrian travelers aren't like that. It's about Tim going out and finding a reliable, affordable, good horse, and he puts a saddle on that animal, and these two species then set off on a journey of inner and outer exploration. It's got nothing to do with somebody giving you a blue ribbon, because you give it to yourself.
Fantastic. Yeah, well, now you're selling me on this. Maybe I could do it. I don't know, though. I'm a bit like, you know, I live in the suburbs here. I'd be like checking my email on my phone all the time.
Well, I'll give you a good example. I'll give you a good example of this and how this affects people. One of the original founding members is a guy from Maine named DC Vision. And this guy had never been near a horse, not on one, never stood next to one.
Wow.
And he set off on a journey across the United States with a Shire mare from a Maine logging camp, and he rode 14,000 miles nonstop to the United States. And so what you're talking about is not about taking horses and making them jump over painted sticks or making them stick their legs out in some sort of ornate gymnastic ballet movement. You're talking about you and your horse exploring part of the world. And there are things that you do and don't do, but these are things that everybody can do, and that's the difference.
Yeah, you raise an interesting sort of point there, too, that I hadn't really considered even having read the book, but you crystallized it so well, too, that it's like, it's really strange that back in the day, and we're talking like 100 years ago, 150 years ago, whatever, you know, almost everybody probably had a horse, or the vast majority, you know, the majority of people probably had horses. And now it's
only
these rich fat cats are the ones who can afford the horses. And normal people that have horses, you know, probably have to work like a second job to maintain the horse. It's like this law of supply and demand actually has really been reversed.
You're right about this, and there's a really interesting dimension to this, and it ties into deadly equines. And that is that, for the sake of argument, let's say we're talking about our great-grandfathers. You know, those people had access to the daily information about horses that most people today don't have a clue about.
Right.
I mean, there were just, you know, in the book, I explain this in the horse travel handbook I'm writing about. You know, when I try to tell people how you go about buying a horse, if I tell someone, can you go out and buy me a car? I mean, you can tell your little 18-year-old sister, go buy me a car, and she's going to go out and go, okay, let's see, the door closes, the odometer works, the gas tank doesn't leak, it starts, okay, the tires aren't flat, she'll bring you a car back. If you go say, go buy me a horse, she can't do it. And people used to have that sort of knowledge, Tim.
Yeah.
They could make journeys, they knew how to feed horses, they knew what horses were like, and part of what the Deadly Equine Project demonstrates is that there was a lot of information previously known to the equestrian world that's now been lost.
Indeed, yeah, you're bringing this out, you know, into the public eye again, which is fantastic. Like I said, it changed my whole view of horses. Now, before we've already gone off on quite a side road here. Let's do the bio background. You know, who is Cucullin O'Reilly, and you know, how did you get interested in horses, and take us sort of on your journey, and then how you discovered essentially the O'Reilly anomaly.
Well, I have a twin background in investigative journalism and in equestrian exploration. And I graduated from Mid-American University and took my journalism degree there. I briefly worked for the Seattle Times as a city reporter, and then I was hired to start a very controversial journalism program, which was headquartered in Peshawar, Pakistan, and I formulated the first journalism program for the Afghan Mujahideen. I got all the different resistance leaders together, and I got the best people they had, and I trained them to be journalists, and we put them into the country, and we were the first people to report on the jihad against the Soviets at that time. And when all that was finally finished, then I resumed my career as an equestrian explorer, and I made journeys in Pakistan, and that resulted in my book called Khyber Nights. And then at the same time, you know, I was really reaching a crossroads here personally, and I had decided that, you know, equestrian exploration meant more to me than writing about what was happening in Seattle or, you know, any other big city.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that there was a real need to preserve mankind's information about horses. And as I explain in the book, you know, the whole concept of equestrian history right now is just, it's almost gone. And those books that are available are basically just parroting what's been said before. And so there is, I don't see very much evidence of any new sort of research. And I think that's really a sad thing and a bad commentary on the situation.
Yeah, absolutely. You point that out in the book, too, that, you know, there's all these, you can take all kinds of crazy courses in colleges nowadays, but it seems like there's a very limited amount that's around horses and horse history. And as you point out, horse archaeology, which is, you know, would you think that would be like second only to humans. You see all kinds of crazy stuff going on with horses throughout human history. So,
well, you know, it's interesting that let's take the year 1900. And in 1900, what they described as the urban herd that lived inside London was so vast you just couldn't believe it. I mean, there were so many hundreds of thousands of horses that lived in London, and they did everything. They pulled the trams, they delivered the goods, you know, they took people to work, they delivered the doctor to the patients. Horses were there, and they didn't just live in, you know, the little stable behind the house. They lived in sheds, they lived in alleys. There was one four-story horse stable there, and they jump over to New York. There was a stable in New York that was one city block.
Wow.
That's how big it was. We're talking maybe 1,000 horses.
Holy
and
Moses.
The impact of these animals on human development had reached a pinnacle. And yet, when you look at what they were doing and the influence that they had on us as a species, and that wasn't very, very long ago. And now, where is it? And who's talking about it? You know, it's just been pushed right to the edge, and we just almost don't even discuss it.
Yeah. I'm stunned to hear, you know, more about this. You just how prevalent these horses were. It's amazing. It's like a shared society that we, you know, and we've cast them out from modern society. It's just bizarre,
well, you know,
in a way,
well,
looking at the history of
when,
it.
When you think about American culture, you know, we think about, well, I'll give you two names, John Wayne and John Ford. You know, think about the great Calvary movies with John Wayne in them. You know, and so he pulls his saber and he goes charge, and there he goes riding across Monument Valley. Meanwhile, back in New York, you probably had 500,000 horses living in that city. And the things that happened there with horses on a daily basis were just, you know, you have to understand horses were as prevalent as cars, and people knew as much about them as cars. You know, I'll give you another example of history that may probably startle you. In 1872, there was a giant equine epidemic called the epizootic.
Yeah,
and it started at a farm in Canada.
Book, yeah.
And it raced and started in September, and it raced straight down to Cuba, went all as far as Panama. It raced all the way over to California, and it just decimated the entire equine population of North and Central America. And who remembers that today and talks about it?
Well, yeah, and you point out in the book that it, to go beyond that, it decimated the population of horses, and then all the, you know, it's like what people say what would happen if the power went out nowadays. It's like all the cities ground to a halt because there's such a shortage of horses, right?
right? Literally. I mean, Boston burned to the ground because there was a fire started in Boston and they couldn't get the horses to pull the fire engines and Boston burned, you know? Everything rotted in the harbor in New York. I mean, you know, the great story is that the U.S. cavalry was reduced to fighting the Apaches on foot because there was no horses in Arizona. So you look at what happened in 1872, and then you look at our dependency today on highways and trucks and that sort of system, and you can see the parallels, and it's pretty frightening.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's frightening and amazing, really. That's like I said, when I finished reading the book, and already just from this brief conversation we've had so far, I mean, I'm learning so much. So kudos to you, Colin, because you know, you're bringing some serious knowledge to the listeners. Now, how did you end up sort of discovering the O'Reilly anomaly? Because, you know, you point out in the book that you really struggled with this as you first sort of came upon it and then decided, you know, to go all in on it because you just couldn't deny it anymore. So talk about, you know, that journey.
I think it's important to say, to explain to the listeners something, something fundamental, and that is that humans have known that horses can consume protein different times. I mean, when the book was released, there were originally 18 different types of meat, including human, that we knew horses had eaten. And this had occurred in 30 countries over a space of 4,000 years.
Yeah.
And I'm writing what's now, I call it the horse travel handbook. It's actually bigger than that. It's the largest study of equestrian travel ever made, and it's going to allow people to read the book and then undertake a journey from Mongolia to Montana. It won't matter. You can go anywhere in the world with this book and you can buy a horse and ride and explore.
Hmm.
And when I came to the point where I had to write about, well, what do you feed the horse? I had to reference information that I had collected over, you know, decades. And I knew that people had fed horses meat. I had read this earlier when I first went to Afghanistan, before the Soviets invaded in the late 70s. I had already read then that the Swedish explorer Sven Hedin had witnessed meat-eating horses in Tibet. And I recently was in contact with an editor, and I said, when I saw the words on the page, I could see the words, but I couldn't accept it. I mean, it just went into my brain, but it never really, I couldn't grasp it.
Yeah.
And the same thing happened in 1954 when National Geographic magazine reported that the entire Kazakh tribe fled the Chinese invasion and they rode meat-eating horses out of China into India. And there the words were right there on the page. It's November 1954, National Geographic, meat-eating horses, a tribe of people, etc. And you look at it and you go, yeah, right. And then you keep thinking, you just keep moving on. And so what happened was with this project is that when I went to sit down and say, okay, and I need to summarize this. I need to tell long riders that if you're someplace, you can feed horses apricots, bananas, mangoes, grain, corn, sorghum. Oh, by the way, you can feed them meat. And I said, you know, I have some examples, but I just better take a look at this and see. Maybe I've overlooked something. And I'd say, Tim, I already had a lot of examples, most of them from Central Asia, from Tibet. And when I stopped, this was in January, so I'll just take a quick look, see if it's any, you know, see how much bigger it might be.
Right.
And I was really floored. I couldn't believe what was there right in front of me, in front of all of us. I mean, it's literally, you know, you see those trick pictures where you look at the picture and you go, oh, you know, it's one kind of picture, and then you realize, oh, wait a minute, there's something else in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those kind of images, that's what it was with this. I mean, when you know what to look for, the evidence was just suddenly all in front of me, and that's what happened.
Interesting. Okay, so just amazing stuff. Let's talk about some of the evidence, because that's, you know, what is particularly interesting throughout the book. You know, I have just a boatload of notes here. So, you know, instead of asking you about all of the sort of ancient cases, you know, why don't you talk a little bit just sort of about how these things have shown up in the ancient times. You mentioned in the book King Diomedes and his savage equines, this whole story with Alexander the Great, the dappled demon of Japan. So this is something that not only spans thousands of years, as you say, but many countries as well, especially now looking here in the ancient stuff.
Well, you know, I think it's really interesting that you brought up Alexander the Great and the dappled demon, because most of us in the West, Western Europe and North America and Australia, we have been told this fairy tale that, well, little 12-year-old Alexander trained, I mean, he, you know, Bucephalus, his mighty war horse, was afraid of his shadow, and he moved the horse around, and he jumped on his back. And in fact, as the book explains, there was a much darker story. Bucephalus was a notorious man-killing, meat-eating horse, and the young prince, Alexander, went into this enclosure and got on that horse and rode him, thereby demonstrating his courage and his ability to overcome this dreadful monster. Now, that story was, like, pretty shocking, but within a couple of days, I discovered a mirror image of that story that happened 1,850 years later, 8,000 miles away in Japan. The Japanese have a story also about a young prince who encounters another vicious, meat-eating, man-killing horse, and he also rises to power by the same action. So what it demonstrates is that mankind has known about this, and that the evidence has been there, and it's only in the last 75 years that this has largely been suppressed.
Indeed, yeah. So, like, it was probably like common knowledge kind of back in the day, maybe back in, you know, I'm thinking about like the 1800s in America and stuff, that horses could eat meat. But I think it's interesting, too, that you point out in the book that you sort of make the distinction that we have two threads here that are running throughout the book, and they obviously cross at various times. But as you say in the book, it's the shocking true story of meat-eating and murderous horses. So we're talking about two separate sort of traits, if you will. There's the meat-eating right. part, and then there's also this idea, and you point out in the book numerous times, you know, that the common misconception amongst the mainstream is that the horse is an animal of prey, that it does not, you know, go out. It's not predatory. But as you say in the book, there's evidence that that's not the case at all. So we're talking about, like I said, meat-eating and murderous, a.k.a. predatory horses, like two separate traits that you've uncovered here. And as you say, they cross at various points, too.
Absolutely. I talk in the book about material that was supplied by Professor Richard Bullitt of Cornell, and how he talks about how horses operate in our world, how we view them today. And he has a theory called post-domesticity. And what it is that horses are now seen as almost fantasy figures. You know, they're gentle, they're quiet, they're angelic. You know, they're descended from Atlantis. These sort of things that, you know, they're just romantic figures, and we see them in a very idealized way. They, you know, horses have big eyes like babies, and people see them and they gravitate to them, and they look beautiful. And what we don't appreciate, most of us in the modern world, because we don't live with horses on a daily basis like our predecessors did, is that horses can be incredibly dangerous. And the deciding factor with me about making this separate book, like I said, originally I was just going to mention meat-eating horses in terms of equestrian exploration. But I discovered that in the year 2007, a child had been killed in a really savage way in Australia. And I thought, you know, and I really grappled with this. I thought, you know, I don't need this. I don't want to do this. I just don't want the hassle of this. But I thought, well, you know, he was just an infant. I think he was 18 months old. And I thought, you know, maybe I ought to say something. You know, there's an ethical situation here. Maybe I ought to warn the public. And so I did that. That was the deciding factor in doing the book. But what's interesting, I think, is what happened after the book was released. Because almost immediately, there was five similar incidents where other people, including children, were also found to have been just absolutely savagely killed. And this gets back to the murderous part of horses. You know, they're very dangerous. They're not the benign, quiet little creatures that we like to think they are.
Yeah. Spooky stuff. Spooky. I've only been around a horse like twice, and they're kind of off-putting to me, so maybe I sensed it. I don't know. But I always think back to Christopher Reeve. If a horse can fell Superman, then there's something unsavory about them in a way. A little bit that makes me nervous, I guess.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You're a well-read guy. You've traveled. You've done things. You know a lot of different kinds of things, and yet you've got this this sort of creepy instinct that, you know, that maybe they're not what I think they are. Maybe I ought to be a little cautious. You know, look, if you're 12 years old and you see the movie The Omen and you think, whoa, Rottweilers, kind of bad dogs, better be careful the next time I see one.
Yeah.
Now, that's perfectly acceptable in today's modern world. But horses, you know, people look at me, oh, no, no. I mean, your girlfriend or your sister or her mom will say, oh, no, no, horses won't hurt you. They're gentle herbivores. And yet your instinct tells you something. And what history demonstrates is that you're right and they're wrong, okay? Because horses can and do absolutely incredible acts of viciousness. And that's what the book's got so much evidence of.
Yeah, yeah. Shocking stuff in the book, too, with regards to that kind of stuff. Well, let's do one of these stories. Can you tell us the story of – let's talk about the man-eater of Ode.
You know, it's an interesting thing about this story. This story happened in the 1820s, and the British monarchs were in they had a policy of occasionally giving very fine equines as a gift to other monarchs. Later on in the 1840s, for example, they sent some beautiful draft horses to the Maharaja of the Sikhs. But this predated that. In the 1820s, King George IV sent a valuable thoroughbred stallion to the Maharaja of Ude in India, in the Princely State of India. And a few years later, an early English journalist named, his name slips my mind right now.
William Knighton.
That's right, of course, Knighton. Knighton was there. So Knighton and another Englishman were in a carriage going to have lunch with the Maharaja when they see a dead body in the street, and the body has been just savage, just torn to bits. It's almost unrecognizable. And they are wondering what's happened when an Indian soldier on a rooftop yells at them to get out of the street that the man-eater is loose. And they had heard about this infamous horse, and they saw this animal coming, this horse coming at them with a dead child in its mouth. And when it saw the two men, now this is interesting, it didn't flee. It had a decision to make. It saw the two Englishmen, and it came after them. And so they turned the carriage, and they bolted themselves. They dashed the carriage into a compound, shut the gates, and saved their lives. And that's when they first met this horse. And, of course, then the horse was later recaptured, and he's put into a ring with a tiger, and he defeats the tiger, just literally kicks the hell out of it, breaks its jaw and defeats it. But what's so interesting about this example is, you know, you can say, why did this horse do this? I mean, this horse had a choice. You know, if you think about if a cow escapes from your grandfather's pasture and runs off into the forest, he doesn't lurk in the trees waiting for granddad to come out so he can eat him, does he?
No.
But that's what this horse did. This English horse got loose and then systematically went through the streets of Lucknow killing people and tearing them apart. And, you know, what we can understand and what there is no debate about today is why this happened. And I'm going to reference back here real quickly to the original episode. The first child that was killed was in Australia in 2007. And I just recently got new evidence of a terrible killing in Oklahoma. And like the man-eater of Lucknow, there was a horse that had a decision. He was in a pasture. There was a fence between him and the front yard of a house. There was a four-year-old child in the front yard. This horse jumped the fence and tore the kid to pieces in front of his parents and killed him. So we're talking about a kind of equine behavior that most people don't know exists and have a hard time grasping that, you know, how can this be possible? And yet right now there are no answers.
Weird stuff. Just weird. Yeah, that's an amazing story too, the man-eater of Lucknow, because just it's as you said, 1820.
Yeah, 1820.
Yeah, so we're talking maybe nearly about 200 years ago, and this is back when things were fairly sophisticated. This isn't some campfire story this guy's telling. He's an English journalist who went down there and documented this.
Let me jump in and say something. Within 48 hours, no, I'll say 24 hours, within 24 hours of the book being released, I got an email in from the British long writer Penny Turner. Now, Penny Turner is British, but she lives in Greece, and she sent me evidence from India. That's kind of how, you know, the New World works.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I just read about the man-eater of Lucknow. You better look at this YouTube video. And I think I probably sent you the link to that. And there is YouTube video, which was just recently taken in Bombay, India, and it's an example of the same equine savage behavior repeating itself in the modern world. A horse is loose in the streets of Bombay, you know, Mumbai, as they call it nowadays,
yeah.
And a man tries to go up and hit it with a rock, and the horse just misses tearing out this guy's throat, grabs him and shakes him viciously, and then attacks this human. And if you read about the Man-Eater of Lucknow, and then you look at the YouTube video, you can see the links between the equine behavior. So this has definitely not gone away. It's still among us.
Yeah. I don't know if you sent me that or not. I'll have to check again. I'll let you know, because I want to see that video now.
It's very shocking.
All this is shocking. I mean, to anyone who, as you said, and kind of pointed out in the book, you know, this Disneyfication of horses, you know, then you hear these stories and you're like, whoa, wait a minute. I as you said, I'm right to be spooked out. But they're massive creatures. That's what people don't understand. Have you never been near one? I mean, like I said, I've only been next to one like twice, and they're huge, man. They're like, they're scary big.
Well, you know, I was really shocked when Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, you know, the famous author of Sherlock Holmes, he wrote a lot of other things. And Arthur Conan Doyle described the horse as the most frightening and savage creature in the animal kingdom. Now you think, wait a minute, you know, you think of lions or, I mean, you know, rhinoceroses or elephants. You don't think of the horse being that way. But when we, let's go back to what you just said. When you think of a 1,200-pound animal with hooves like steel, with a big long neck, with savage teeth, and when he lays his ears back and he comes at you, then you're in a lot of trouble. And you know, let's look at another one of the stories that's in the book, the infamous story of Lisette, the French mare in the Napoleonic War. This horse was in the campaign in Russia with Napoleon, and her rider, the French officer, surrounded by Russian attacking soldiers, rips the skin off one guy's face. You know, he was described as looking like a living death's head mask, and then grabs an officer by the stomach, carries this guy out of the field of battle, disembowels him. I mean, when you think about what horses can physically do to human beings, you have a very good reason to be afraid.
Yeah, yeah. I remember that story from the book. It's like, whew, you know.
Well, actually, there's another story now, because an English author, an expert on the Napoleonic era named Jonathan Hopkins, contacted me after the book was released and said, oh, there's another episode. Turns out that there was an English horse, an Arab mare called Fatima, and she was ridden by an English officer fighting against Napoleon's troops in Spain. And she not only attacked the French troops, but she had a bad habit of eating all of her officers' food and the food that belonged to the men. They used to have to tie their food up in sacks and tie it up in tree limbs to keep the food from Fatima.
Wow.
Yeah.
Crazy stuff, man. Just absolutely crazy stuff. I loved this book so much because you're uncovering so much material that I never even heard of or you know, just does not make it out to the mainstream at all. Well, hopefully this book will change that. Now, what I thought, speaking of that sort of idea of this stuff being excised from the mainstream, you spend a lot of time in the book talking about the use of horses in the exploration of the North and South Pole, which I thought was really interesting because, again, you think of the North and South Pole, you almost always think about dog sleds. You never really hear about the horses, and it sounds like the meat-eating aspect of the horse behavior is what made it such a key, I guess you could say, asset in these explorations.
You know, because the Long Riders Guild documents all different types of equestrian exploration, we had known that there were horses that were used in the original effort to try to reach the North Pole, and we also definitely knew that they had been used in Antarctica. But we didn't know the links and how they connected back and forth. And we were, of course, completely in the dark about the meat-eating aspect of this. But as the book explains, the Siberian culture has a special horse called the Yakut horse, and these horses routinely live in -60-degree weather. And I don't mean just live in it. I mean the Yakut horsemen go out and they get on their horses and they ride around on this on these animals, because you know they're used to this. Horses and humans are. And there was an Englishman named Frederick Jackson Turner. He made a 3,000-mile trip across Siberia with these horses. And then he was asked to explore the Arctic Circle, and he took some of these horses into the Arctic, and he was shocked to discover that they ate polar bear meat. And they were so hardy, and they did so well, that he wrote about it in his book. So when Sir Ernest Shackleton, the Irish explorer, decided that he was going to try to reach the South Pole, he had a conference with Jackson and was encouraged to take horses to Antarctica. So now you've got Siberia, the Arctic Circle, and now you've got it linked to Antarctica. And Shackleton took horses to Antarctica. But what's really, really interesting is that Shackleton knew, of course, there's no grass, there's no grain. So he did take compressed fodder, you know, some sort of green feed, and he took corn. But already by 1910, the British Army was well aware that horses could eat meat. It's actually, I explain in the book, it's actually in the British Cavalry Manual that they can eat meat. So Shackleton conferred with the British military, and the British military at the Aldershot Military Depot came up with something called the Maji Ration, which is a meat-based ration for horses. And Shackleton fed his horses meat in Antarctica. And, you know, you're talking about an episode now, not just of exploration history, but of equestrian history that's just dropped off the earth. And when this was revealed on the giant Explorer's Web, it's called X-Web, there was just a shocking silence from the polar community. They, like you said earlier, Tim, everyone says, oh, you know, dogs, sleds, you know, the great race between the English and the Norwegians, Amundsen and Scott. And, you know, there was actually two equestrian exploration teams down in Antarctica at the same time, and they both had horses that ate meat. So you're talking about a whole section of equestrian history that has just been erased, gone.
It's so strange. I mean, we'll get into sort of like why that's happened as we go along, but that's just so strange. And, you know, to the people out there that are skeptical, Cucullin points out right now just that, you know, we're talking about the British War Manual from the 1910s, I guess you could say. 1913, I think, is the one that you cite in the book. I mean, we're talking about like official government documents here, which are saying that feeding horses meat is what goes on, is what can be done, is what should be done. So,
well,
I mean, it's undeniable, sort of proof in a way, you know?
This gets back to another link that we suspect now. You know, imagine if you can, you know, there's a big flat table in front of us, and let's say that we've got all these little black dots, and you go, okay, I'm going to put one dot here, and then you move another dot. Oh, wait a minute, it's sort of like a puzzle. Well, oh, wait, this piece fits this. And then as you sort of work on it and think about it and ponder it and look at it, you say, wait a minute, I'm kind of putting things together here. Well, what we now are beginning to wonder is, where did the British military get the idea to feed horses meat? Now, we do know that there had been a sort of a remote reference to a siege earlier in European history where horses had eaten meat. But that probably wasn't enough for the cavalry to come up with this conclusion. But what we now are wondering is, did the British military get the idea from Tibet? Because at the turn of the 20th century, the British military invaded Tibet. And the Tibetans, we now know, fed their horses meat and they feed them blood. And we're wondering if that expedition under a guy named Younghusband, we're wondering if the British cavalry officers who went into Tibet realized that horses were omnivorous and they could be fed meat and blood, and did that information then return to London, make it into the cavalry manual, and is that what gave them the idea to come up with the Maji ration that went to Antarctica? We don't know yet. That's speculation. But you can see how we're kind of going in that direction.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, it does seem like, based on the stories in the book too, that, you know, and we'll sort of get into the pros and cons of all this in modern times in a little bit, but it's like, it seems like in the book, based on the stories, that feeding the meat to these horses is actually kind of beneficial. It makes them stronger and more prepared for these arduous journeys, which I thought was interesting too. It's not just this sort of that they're eating it just to get by, in a sense. They're eating it because it's beneficial to the trip, it's beneficial to the horse, you know, it's actually good for the creature.
We have to ask ourselves, why do we care what a horse eats? I mean, I thought about this, before I talked to you, I was thinking, you know, if I'm watching a baseball team, and I see some great pitcher up on the mound, and he, you know, he throws a no-hitter, and I think, wow, that was a fantastic athletic performance. I don't think about what did he have for breakfast. Okay, I don't have a dogmatic belief that, you know, this guy's a vegetarian, therefore he's more pure. I think, what a great no-hitter. Okay, so why do we, this is the question I'm going to pose to your listeners, why do we as a culture have a problem with what a horse consumes? I mean, what does a horse do? A horse gives us emotional relief, he frees us from gravity, and he liberates us from the prejudices of the village. And so these are the three traditional things that he's always done for us. And what he eats doesn't affect what he does. And so if you look at cultures like Bhutan, where horses are eating meat right now, they're eating yak meat, or Kazakhstan, where they're still feeding them different meats, if you look at cultures in the East that don't have a problem with this concept, then you look at the cultures like America and England, who are really grappling with this, you have to ask yourself, why? And is this personal? Is this cultural? Is this national? I really don't have the answer yet, but, you know, this is where some of the opposition is coming from.
Interesting stuff. Yeah, I don't have an answer for that either. Just it seems like it must be cultural, because you look at sort of – there's sort of this, like, weird food bias anyway in America as it is. I mean, we're very sort of a constricted country, even though it's such a free place. You know, we police ourselves in a sense where it's, you know, there's no swearing or nudity on TV, that kind of stuff, and – you know, the government's trying to mess with people, what they can eat all the time. So it's, you know, there's sort of a weird food hang-up anyway. So I can kind of see maybe how that would also extend to horses. You touched on this story here earlier in the conversation. That's Ernest Schaefer, the German explorer who filmed the horses eating the blood meal in Tibet. What I thought was interesting you point out in the book is that it sort of jumps over a roadblock in a sense of the meat-eating horse idea, where it's like these Tibetan horses prove or indicate that meat eating is not something that is done in times of necessity or emergency when it comes to these horses. It's just part of their diet. So it sort of eliminates the whole idea where it's like, yeah, they can eat meat, but only in extreme circumstances when you have nothing else to feed them. But it's like, no, actually, you know, it can be a part of their regular diet. It's not just something you do when there's no grass left.
Yeah, the book has some back in January, when I started looking for relevant modern examples of what people viewed or how they defined horses in Europe and North America, I came across some really astonishing blanket statements. And you go to, you know, allexperts.com, and, you know, Susie Bloggs is an expert on horses, and Susie says horses are herbivores, and if you feed them meat, it will kill them. You know, and I think, gee, Suze, you might want to kind of, you know, reconsider that. But no, that's just the way it is. And there's lots of statements like that, and they're all linking into each other, and they're all very they're very committed. You know, this is the way it is, and, you know, by God, there's no discussing it. But like you just brought up, there's lots of evidence, and there's other cultures that indicate otherwise. And I think this gets back to how I discussed in the book about the concept of willful blindness. You know, people, we have to ask ourselves, you know, why are we holding on to this idea? You know, is that cultural? Is that linguistic? Is that sexual? I mean, what I'm discovering is that a lot of the people that are against this idea are women, because they have an idealized view of horses. The Society of the Military Horse, which is largely, you know, cavalry guys, they go, oh, yeah, well, sure, why not? And this isn't to say that lots of the evidence coming in isn't from women, but I think women more than men have more of a romanticized view of horses, and that may be part of this.
Interesting. Well, like, yeah. Sort of like, there's so many threads to pull on here. It's just amazing. I'm sort of moving through my notes here as we go across the pages here of the book. And what I also thought was interesting is that you know, as I said, this thing's just chock full of making the case for the meat-eating horses. You point out that the teeth, the jaw, the digestive system of the horses are pretty much the same or very similar to humans. You know, there's no major sort of differences, which indicates that, you know, omnivorous behavior is possible. It could happen. It's not something that, like you said, the expert said, if you feed a horse meat, it'll die. It's like, no, that's not the case at all. So according to what you've uncovered here, the teeth, the jaw, the digestive system are all up to snuff, if you will, for meat consumption, right?
Right. You know, it's let's you and the listeners and I, let's back up a minute. Let's go back to something that let's look at science. And science, let's look at the dictionary.
Mm-hmm.
And the dictionary says that an omnivore is an organism, an animal that eats plants and animals. You know, now if you eat lettuce on your hamburger, you're an omnivore. And what we are discussing is the possibility that a horse can be an omnivore. Now, when the book was released, we had 18 different examples of different kinds of meat that we knew horses had eaten. Antelope, polar bear, I'm trying to remember them all, moose, seals, whale meat. Okay, we came out with 18 different examples. But within the first 72 hours of the book being released, more evidence just kept pouring in. We knew about horses in Arabia being fed raw camel meat. We knew about a horse in America that ate live crayfish. We discovered that the BBC had filmed horses eating live crabs off a beach.
Huh.
And within, I think, the first week, we had a guy write us and say, I finished reading the book, and I was really curious, so I went out and I offered my horse a pound of ground beef, and he ate it, raw ground beef. And I thought, well, you know, that's my definition of an omnivore. I think that's what we have to look at here. You know, the definition is one thing. Here's the evidence. Now, you know, make up your mind about it.
Exactly. Yeah. It seems like such an open and shut thing. It seems like such an easy sort of, there shouldn't be an argument about it. But actually, I guess, leads to sort of what we're talking about now, which is sort of the reaction to the book. And you know, as you point out in the book, the intellectual equestrian vacuum, and just how this whole thing has sort of been just pushed off the table, pushed off the radar. Like, why... What was, I guess, well, just to start in that realm of discussion, what's been the reaction to the book since it's come out? It sounds like it's been overwhelmingly positive from the lay people, and maybe.
I was contacted by a really respected Swedish horseman, and it was about 2 weeks after the book had been released. He said, "Where are the haters?" And I wrote back and I said, I don't know. I'm waiting for the deluge of hate mail to come in, and it hasn't showed up. And what has arrived is enough new evidence to put out a second edition.
There's, oh, wow,
definitely enough of that. There's no doubt about that. And people overwhelmingly saying, you know, these are average horse. Now, I'm not talking about experts. I'm not talking about editors. I'm talking about just average horse people who are writers and readers, writing and going, ah, yeah, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I understand now. That explains why such and such thing happened. And so the horse world, by and large, has said, okay, open-minded, look at the evidence. And like you earlier described the book, you said there's so much evidence there. Well, at the end of the book, you go, I'm a little shocked. I was squeamish, but upon reflection, I think it's probably right. I think horses could be capable of doing this. But there's an example that I really want to share with you and your listeners, and that's the reception that the book got from two vastly different audiences. When the book was released, there was a website devoted to cryptozoology.
Mm-hmm.
And it got picked up really quickly. And the people basically said, you know, what a load of crap and what a load of hokum and forget it. And, you know, I just don't buy it. So I went in there and I – and I don't do Facebook or any of that kind of stuff. So, but I went in there. I registered, look, this is who I am. And here's the evidence. And they were very receptive and really, really polite. And they went, wow, you know what? I think you're right. Well, about a week later – the far end of the spectrum, an anti-cryptozoology forum, you know, anti-Bigfoot, anti-UFO, anything, the skeptics, if that's what you want to call it, they waded in and said, oh, my God, here's this ridiculous book. And once again, I introduced myself, and I presented the evidence. And they, too, very polite, very open-minded, went, you know what, I think you're right. And what I think is so important about these two audiences is that they're not equestrian. They're just people, and if you sit down with them, you say, okay, look, I'll just put it on the table, and you decide. And I think that's what I'm talking about. You know, you're such a great example of this, Tim. I mean, you look at the book, you go, well, I don't know. You know, I see a lot of kooky stuff in my life, and I don't know. And at the end of the book, you go, you know what? I think the guy's kind of right. And that's what these two audiences proved. I mean, if you put the evidence on the table, there it is. And there's so much overwhelming evidence for this that I think that's what most people who have seen the book have said. They say, yeah, I think he's right.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I mean, I highly encourage people to pick up this book. It'll change your perspective on the animal. Really, not just horses, but the animal kingdom in general. It's made me a little bit sort of keep an eye on all sorts of stuff with regards to what animals may really be capable of. Now, you say sort of you've gotten the good response from the lay people. What about, as you point out in the book, you know, the horse industry, despite the fact that it seems like less and less people are owning horses all the time, is actually like a multi-million dollar industry. And a lot rides on that romanticized version of the horse. So you come along, you know, riding in on your man-eating horse, and you know, I'm sure that it's created a stir, you know, in the big money sectors of the horse industry. So what's been the sort of the reaction of, you know, the money players, if you will?
Well, it's interesting because the host of America's largest equestrian radio show contacted me immediately. And I don't know this guy. And I said, yeah, I know who you are. Okay, what do you, you know, what do you want to talk about? And he said, I want to talk about this book. And I said, all right, I'll send it to you. And he looked at it, and he says, you know, my God. And now this is a guy who is a very knowledgeable horseman. Mm-hmm. He's an author himself. He's a equestrian historian. And at the beginning of his show, he said, I think this is one of the most important shows I've ever done, and I have to warn the audience, you're going to have to keep an open mind. And at the end of the interview, he said, this book has redefined horses for us. Now, you know, this is a guy who has a vested interest in maintaining the status quo, and yet he had the editorial courage to say that on, you know, live on air.
Mm-hmm.
And what I have found is that there are two different kinds of editors in the equestrian world. The independent editors are willing to look at the evidence and go, okay, yeah, let's look at it. Let's talk about it. Let's consider the possibility. Let's give it to our readers. And remember, there's something really important here. There's an ethical consideration. You're talking about horses perpetrating acts of incredible savagery that absolutely destroy human bodies. I mean, the way that they kill people is just off the scale.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to ask yourself, as an editor, do I tell the public that horses are capable of more than just biting and kicking? So there have been cases in London and in the United States where the editors of two of the world's largest equestrian magazines have said, absolutely no way, under any circumstances, are we going to discuss this issue or tell our readers about it.
Huh.
And I think that that's shocking, really shocking.
Yeah, that is shocking. That's just ridiculous. You know, you wonder, did they even read the book?
No. I offered them the book. I showed them all the evidence. I told them about all the new evidence that continued to pour in. The editor of I'm going to be honest with you. The editor of Horse and Hound magazine, which is the largest equestrian magazine in England, she wrote and she said, based upon my 10 years of experience as the editor of this English magazine, I do not believe this is possible. And I wrote back and said, well, I'm sorry, based upon 4,000 years of evidence in human history, you know, you might consider being mistaken. And she said, I don't care. I'm not telling the readers. And Western horsemen in America flat refused to tell anybody. Now, I think you have to ask yourself a couple of really interesting points about these magazines. And because you don't follow the equestrian industry, mm-hmm. I have to say this to your listeners, that equestrian magazines, by and large, they're declining. Their readership is falling off sharply, and they're not followed, you know, thanks to all the new media that we have. You know, you don't have to get the monthly magazine to find out how to do something or whatever. So it took me about 4 weeks to understand what was happening, and it finally dawned on me, wait a minute. It's not the readers that matter to the editors, it's the advertisers. And I thought, that's what it is. They don't want to upset the advertisers. They don't want to upset the status quo. They don't want to upset the way the horse is perceived because there is there's an entrenched view and it makes money. And
right.
So a book like this comes along and it shocks everyone.
Exactly, yeah. And we're talking about specialized advertisers here. This isn't like Bud Light or something like that. This is like some dude selling horse equipment and stuff. They don't want people to start getting concerned about horses and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I'm friends with the art editor of an equestrian magazine in London, and you know, the spring fashion edition is one of the big things. You know, what color jodhpurs are the girls going to be wearing this year? So, I mean, I'm not making that up. That's the truth. And so, you know, when you're selling, you know, unicorn books and wallpaper, and you know, you want, you know, people to buy pony stuff, you don't want them to think, you know, about this kind of stuff. In fact, I joked with one of the editors, and I said, well, for all those fathers who are being plagued by little girls, you know, who want riding lessons, or even worse, asking their daddies to buy them a horse, I suggest that you give these little girls a copy of Deadly Equines and have them read them at night.
Yeah, that would eliminate that whole daddy buy me a pony thing.
That's right.
Now, you said that touches on something, and, you know, we're obviously, you know, we don't want to get into some kind of, like, battle of the sexes here, but you do point out that it seems like you've gotten a lot of resistance from women who romanticize the horses and stuff. Is that sort of also indicative of, like, the whole industry in a sense? You know, you described this conversation with the woman who's the editor of the thing, so you wonder if that goes through all the whole industry.
I think that they a large percentage of the modern westernized equestrian industry is aimed at competition and to a female market. And you have to ask yourself, now this goes back to a broader issue, and why did men leave the equestrian world? You know, we don't use horses on farms. We don't ride them to war, and we don't travel on them. Now, that's changing thanks to the Long Riders Guild. You know, men are just, you know, on horses all over the world now, and it's growing like wildfire. But in a market that is aimed at making, you know, horses, you know, surrogate emotional companions, the idea that he might nip your arm off is a bit, just, you know, a bit upsetting. And yet, this gets back, I want to be really clear about this to your readers, I'm sorry, to your listeners, the people that are writing in are men and women, and the women are coming in with some incredible examples of evidence that it's just absolutely shocking. An American professor wrote and said that this explains why my uncle was killed, that there was a family story. Her uncle was a famous horse trainer, and they didn't know what had happened, and he was basically murdered by a horse in the stall, and the evidence now shows that this is probably what happened. And we just recently received an absolutely astonishing story from America about a horse in 1958. And this is not only the first gelding that we know about, but it's also the first horse that hunted down and killed other animals and ate them and attacked people. And that also came from a woman. So the evidence is coming in from humans, period. Okay, but the marketing is aimed largely at a female market, and that it gets back to corporate decisions, not people, because mm-hmm. the horse people that I'm in contact with are incredibly open-minded. Doesn't matter if they're men or women.
Yeah, we sort of have talked about the impact this book's made on the equestrian industry. Now, when you're sort of dealing, I wouldn't even call this paranormal. I wouldn't even really know what. I guess almost cryptozoological is kind of what we're in the realm of here. But, you know, when you're in the realm of the fringe, if you will, you know, it's always sort of predicated that you get science on board. So what's been the reaction of the scientific community to Deadly Equines?
There hasn't been any. I've been receiving messages saying, let's see, who was it that wrote me the other day? Somebody wrote me the other day and said that this should prompt the scientific community into investigating the possibilities that you've raised. Mm-hmm. And listen, let me back this up and say something important. I'm an investigative reporter and a journalist and a historian and an equestrian explorer. I am not a scientist.
Right.
I mean, I don't pretend to be a scientist. All I did was try to present all the material as I could in the most objective manner as possible. Now, I would think that given the collection that's now available, somebody in the scientific world, be they biologists, zoologists, you know, dietitians, they ought to be going, wait a minute, maybe there's something to this.
Exactly.
Because obviously, if this evidence has been there continually for as long as we've known about horses, and it's happening right now as we talk about this, then, you know, it doesn't take, you know, you don't have to be very smart to understand there could be some very serious scientific implications here.
Absolutely, yeah. You hit the nail on the head. As soon as I finished reading the book, I thought to myself, well, someone should be doing some kind of scientific study to to confirm or lay to waste this sort of the theory, I guess you could say, or the anomaly. But it seems like it's a given. I mean, it's hard to even say that someone should be trying to prove whether or not this is true, because the evidence clearly says that it is. But it's like I said, you need the science. Everybody seems, science is our new god, you know, and it's like you need science to back it up. And I feel like it's stunning that no one's gotten on board to you know, you think they'd have the money in mind or the prestige of proving this in a sense. So I'm just surprised no one's gotten on board to really investigate this.
You know, the book starts with a quote from Professor Stephen Gould. And it says, the most erroneous stories are those we think we know best and therefore never scrutinize or question. And people, this gets back to what I call equestrian amnesia. Now, this doesn't just have to do with equestrian diet. This is just about anything with horses. If horses aren't connected to some sort of competitive national event, people, you know, largely ignore them. Unless, of course, you're talking about North America, and then you're talking about the emotional buttons of horse slaughter and BLM Mustangs, and there's some issues there. But what we ought to be discussing is, you know, what does this mean, and why isn't this being discussed? You know, why isn't this being some sort of, why isn't some scientist come step forward and go, wait a minute, this is really intriguing. But I think what we have to realize is that this, now that this is on the table, and this isn't going to go away. I mean, and like I said, the evidence just keeps, I mean, I just keep getting the emails. They just keep coming in. Okay, here's another example. I can put that one over there in that classification. But the book talks about how in 1960, young Jane Goodall, who wasn't even a doctor at the time, she was just some amateur living in the bushes and in the bush in Africa, she was the first person to ever witness chimps eating meat. And it took the scientific world by storm. And they, you know, no way. Now, chimps eat meat. Or, you know, I'm sorry. You know, what are you doing out there in the brush? No way. But now we understand that chimps do eat meat. We now know the hippos eat meat. And I think same with the horses. I think with time, people are going to go, yeah, we now know that horses are capable of omnivorous action and that they can be incredibly savage. But it's going to take a little while for people to largely grasp that, I think.
Right, right. And what you've done here with the book is sort of light that fuse of change, which is, you know, kudos to you for doing that, for having the courage to go out there and say this in the face of, you know, what could be fantastic ridicule or scorn from the equestrian community. I mean, you really stepped up to the plate here and trying to change people's point of view on this, which is commendable. Because, like I said, after I finished the book, it was, you know, I don't have a vested interest in what horses eat. Like you said earlier, you said, what difference does it make? You know, having finished the book, it was like, okay, you know, just change that thought in my head that horses are omnivores. I mean, that horses are herbivores because they're omnivores, clearly, based on what I've learned here.
I got to tell you something. The book was a week old, and a French horseman stopped by at my house and came in and was talking to him. And my wife showed him the book, and she starts talking to him in French. And, you know, he couldn't read the English, but he put the pictures. Yeah, and? Well, yeah, but, you know, the horses eat meat. Yeah, and he says, well, you know, we feed our horses meat flour. And she said, what? Yeah, yeah, we got this flour, a special flour here in France, and we take all the excess refuse meat and offal, and we make a special meat flour, and it's brown, and you know, we give it to the horses. It gives them extra energy. You didn't know that? No. So the guy leaves, and 5 minutes later, we're on the internet, and bingo, there's a picture, and for €6 a kilo, you can feed your horse meat here in France anytime you want. And it gets back to what you said. You said this much earlier. You said, does this give horses extra energy? You know, if you look at history, I mean, the famous British bandit, Dick Turpin, the story is, you know, his mare, Black Bess, was able to elude the law because he fed her meat and she could outrace the other horses. And, you know, the Old West story of the guy who escaped the Apaches on the meat-eating horse. You know, what happens when we eat meat? You know, we get strong, we get a burst of energy. And so there are cultural applications here and probably practical applications as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What I thought was interesting, too, though, in the book, because, you know, as I said, I finished the book. One of my first thoughts was like, why isn't anyone doing a study on this? And, you know, my second thought was if I had a horse, I would go feed him meat right now. But you sort of advise in the book that that's not, you know, that people maybe shouldn't do that because we don't know exactly, you know, that might lead to the murderous horse behavior.
What I suspect is that we're talking about two different things.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there are 6 known episodes now in recent history, in the beginning of this century, where equines have either torn out human throats or attempted to tear them out and thereby killed the human. And we don't know in each example what triggered this in this particular horse. The original case was in Australia. The little boy was picked up and killed. Then there was a case in Holland where a woman's throat was ripped out. There was an American who went off to Egypt, some kind of horse whisperer, and he narrowly escaped being killed when a horse tried to tear his throat out. There was another episode in India where the guy didn't have his throat torn out, but he was almost killed. And then, of course, there's been the last one now in Oklahoma where the kid was just absolutely torn to bits. So we've got equines that are doing these savage acts. And then, of course, the other threat is they can also eat meat. But does feeding a horse prompt this murderous action? And we only have one example so far of a horse that does both. So there may be no link at all. It may just demonstrate that horses are much more psychologically and complex, and they have a more complex diet than we've understood. But we're not sure yet if, you know, they have a link between the two of them.
Right, right. That's the sort of $64,000 question. So why do you, I guess, just do you err on the side of caution then and tell people not to feed their horses meat? Because also you point out sort of this whole mad cow thing where they think mad cow might have been from feeding cows, you know, parts of other cows and stuff, which that sounds like.
They now know that that's what happened.
I mean, a
cow has a different digestive system than a horse.
Mm-hmm.
A cow has 4 stomachs. And a horse has a single stomach like a human, and a horse has a jaw that can move back and forth and up and down like a human. It has teeth like humans. And so a horse can eat grass or grain or meat like a human. And cows and camels don't eat and digest like that. And so what I, at the end of the book, I warn people, I said, you know, before you run out and feed your horse, you know, a couple of steaks thinking it's going to make him faster, you better be careful because we don't know what we're tampering with. And you have to understand, I think it's important to your listeners that this isn't a new idea, because in the book it explains that at the first Greek Olympics, soon after chariot racing was introduced, one team owner was very upset that his team had lost, and so he didn't exactly cheat. But what he did was he fed his horses meat so that they would have an advantage over the other horses. So this is an old idea. And all you have to do is look at the modern equestrian world to see how much money is involved and see how much competition and nationalism and pride is involved before somebody goes, wait a minute, if I give old Trigger a couple of pounds of hamburger, you know, maybe he's going to do better in the Preakness or something. So you can see how people might want to cut a corner here.
Right, right. Well, that raises sort of something that I thought when I was reading the book is maybe, is it possible here that you've stumbled across, you know, maybe some kind of well-kept secret of the equestrian community, of the modern equestrian community, where it's like, you know, if you got a chance to get to the bar with some of these guys that train the horses that are in the Kentucky Derby, they'd be like, yeah, of course we feed them meat. You know, that's why do you think they're in the Kentucky Derby? Why do you think they're the best of the best? Because we know the secret, which is to feed them meat. Is it possible that could be going on as well?
No, I don't think so. And I had a very interesting email in from a Canadian equestrian journalist, and she said, you know, people now test horses for drugs, mm-hmm. torn after races. But does this raise the possibility that you might be able to give a horse a giant boost of some sort? We can't even determine yet how and if it could happen. But, you know, is there any testing if they eat meat? And what's this going to do in terms of a possibility? You know, what could happen here? You know, if the French are feeding their horses meat flour right now, and we know that over in Orient, in some of the Oriental countries in Central Asia, they're still feeding their horses meat. So how long before, you know, a big feed company says, well, let's see. As long as you stay away from the mad cow idea, which is, you know, cows eating cows.
Right, so you don't feed them horses,
there.
Yeah.
This is different. I mean, and this gets back to the cultural interpretation. You know, if Shackleton can feed his horses meat in Antarctica, well, then what's different about feeding old Dobbin something that's got some meat in it because it gives you more energy? I mean, they've got all these different kinds of feed for horses now. Oh, adult horses, senior horses, horses that are left-handed. You know, they have something they need, and so we've got a special feed for them. I mean, you know, the animal food industry is incredible and very wealthy. So maybe someone's going to come along and explore this idea from a commercial point of view. And if they do, how are they going to overcome the prejudice?
You're going to have to give people copies of your book. Is there really horse food for left-handed horses? Is that just a joke?
That was just a joke.
Okay.
Well, that's just, you know.
That's an example of how extreme it can get.
That's right.
All right. Well, I believed you, so that's how in the dark I am to all this.
There's something about that horse, Buster. You know, it's like we looked at each other, and then there was eye contact, and I was looking at the horse, and the horse was looking at me, and then it hit me. I think, maybe, I was a centaur in my past life.
Well, something tells me you probably were never half man, half horse, but hell, what do I know?
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Dude, I think I was a centaur in my past life. It totally occurred to me.
What makes you think you were half man, half horse?
Charlie.
Come on, out. He's working.
Enjoy the roll.
He's working.
Bro, will you please get out of here? You smell like cheese.
No.
You
all
do
right,
smell
it's
horse.
Well, whatever it is, it's terrible, okay?
So, well, let's call it what it is. It's horse. I have it all over my hands.
Charlie, let's go. Get up.
Cheese.
Well, the horse was eating a lot of cheese then. What? I don't know what it is. Just you stink.
Come on, get up.